way they handled it. All right, the U.S. saw preservation of a non-communist South Vietnam as something important to its interests in the Pacific. This was the realpolitik basis for American involvement. And as we've said, seen over the years, this was perceived in different forms. The Munich syndrome, you know, stop aggression early, or we have to stop it later at a higher price. As a lesson of the Korean War, to discourage communist piecemeal detachment of the free world. Still later, as the equilibrium thesis, the ideological balance of power notion, that is, that an equilibrium, an ideological equilibrium, should exist in Asia, and no single ideological construct, not capitalism, not socialism, not neutralism, should dominate, just as no single country should dominate the area. North Vietnam saw it in its national interest that Hanoi control all of Indochina, for that matter. The Chinese initially saw it in its national interest that the U.S. and other non-communist nations be denied presence in Indochina. This grew out of China's position as a regional power. Later, when China became a global power, a Chinese perception of this national interest changed. The Chinese began the Vietnam War wanting very much for the socialist forces to win. I don't think they wanted a unified North and South Vietnam, but they wanted two Vietnams, one left-leaning sort of Cambodian neutralist type government. Clearly, they began the war wanting no American presence and complete American defeat and disgrace and so on. They wound up the war wanting quite badly for the Americans to win, in the sense of to deny the North Vietnamese victory. Mao Tse-tung, the German ambassador, West German ambassador in Peking, told me about seeing Mao right after the end of the Vietnam War. And Mao was really sore. I mean, he said, you know, the Americans obviously weren't serious about Vietnam. If they were, they wouldn't have not walked out of the place after suffering only 55 or 45,000 casualties. The sense of it was that, you know, we Chinese depended on the Americans to see that the North Vietnamese didn't win the war, and they let us down. I have gotten this at Chinese conferences in China since the war. It's an accusation that you people let us down. And I said, where were you when we needed you? You know, you invaded the country in 79, why didn't you do it in 69? Anyway, but the point was that the German ambassador said, you know, this was a very sardonic remark of Mao, that you left the country, you left after only 45,000 casualties, therefore you weren't serious about it. I said, well, that's just an indication of magnitude in Asia. I suppose to Mao, 45,000 casualties isn't very much. That's his perception. It was not the American perception at the time, of course. Anyway, in terms of national interest, it's simply that the Chinese, as a regional power, didn't want any foreign presence at all in the region if they could accomplish it. China, as a global power, was then obliged to play balance of power politics, and they wanted the Americans there as a kind of trade-off against the Russians. They wanted the Russians there as a kind of trade-off against the Americans, and so on. The Soviet Union and other communist nations, as well as their sympathizers elsewhere, perceived the American purpose as being imperialism and neocolonialism, and also a general effort to hold back the progressive wave of the future. Most non-communist nations, particularly in Asia, saw the war, I'd say the ASEAN countries and the Japanese, saw the war in terms of a test of U.S. determination, staying power, and efficacy in dealing with a new kind of armed struggle. In those days, they were much more nervous about their futures in their own respective countries, and in those days, they saw the Americans as a force that would help prevent revolutionary guerrilla war from developing in their country or winning if they did. And therefore it was seen, particularly in early years, as a test of whether we had the staying power or not. Other nations, particularly in Europe, I think, tended to see the war as a drain on U.S. energies and in no way serving their national interests. Several of us are doing a book now on outsiders' perceptions of the war. I'm doing the chapter on the British and the French. And I hadn't done much work on this, and I've really been struck by how uninterested the British and the French really were in the Vietnam War. And very selfish, you know. They looked at it in terms of what it meant for NATO. That's all. They didn't care one way or the other, about, as far as I can tell, about anything else that happened. They didn't want us to lose, the Americans to lose, because of the possible impact that this would have on NATO. And some, de Gaulle and others, arguing that it's probably better if the Americans lose the war, because that will then return them to where they belong, that is, in Europe and the more important things. Right. Finally, there were those who saw the war without purpose. These were found in many countries, and I would say they're basically of two types. Those who held the view from the start that the war was without purpose, mostly pacifists, and in this country, isolationists. And then there were those who came to embrace this view that the war was without meaning or purpose after years of war. Well, those two groups are quite different in rationale, in motivation, and in motive, and in perception of the war. All right, having considered the more abstract level of perception of the war, we now turn to the finite level. In the two levels just discussed, that is the nature and the essential purpose, your perception of this is largely a reflection of your worldview. It stems from what you believe about the nature of man, the meaning of existence, the purposes of life, in short, your personal philosophy. So as such, it is less given to objective value judgment. The perceptions we now consider are more data or fact-oriented. Here, perceptions can be wrong. It is misperception, in a way that these philosophically based views can never be said to be wrong. It is resting on factual error. There are 11 of these, and I will try to go through them quickly. If we don't get through them all, we'll have to continue on next week. All right, the first of these is response. These are no particular order, really, and probably should be reorganized in something of a more logical order. First has to do with the responsibility for the war. Essentially, it's a question of whether you see this, your perception of war, the responsibility is the responsibility of war criminals, or that you just see it without any particular individual responsibility as a kind of unrolling of history. On one hand, you have the view that the war and the events in the war, the responsibility for this rest with the principal leaders on both sides, maybe to varying assignments of weight, but nevertheless, the essential blame is spread on both sides, on the President of the United States, on the Joint Chiefs of Staff, to a lesser degree on Congress, perhaps, on the succession of South Vietnamese leaders, who did not perform at all well, on Ho Chi Minh and his Politburo in Hanoi, on the leaders in the USSR and China, who funded and thus made the war, continued war possible, and on other world leaders who failed to act. The British and the French, who simply looked at the war in terms of their national interest and no further. The leaders on both sides, according to this perception, the leaders on both sides wanted war, or at least they wanted the fruits of war, and so they pursued it to the bitter end. And whether their motive was patriotism or perfidy or political opportunism or ignorance, whatever the reason, the fact is responsibility still rests with them. Now, standing opposite this is the perception that the Vietnam War, like history itself, largely was beyond the control of any individual or any individual group, any individual group of leadership. Neither side could dominate the situation. No leader on any side had much of a range of options. Rather, there was a kind of inexorableness about the Vietnam War. From the start, it was a tragic course of events which had to work itself out to completion. Adversaries themselves were trapped by these events, and their leaders were prisoners of policy. So if blame must be fixed, it should be fixed, as the French say, on the system, on the system. There is embedded, incorporated in this, something of what has been called the devil thesis, interpreting history, the notion, particularly strong among Americans, that when something goes wrong in history, there has to be a villain. Very common in America, of course, today, as it has been in the past, to blame all social ills on the president. Drugs, homeless, declining morality, declining productivity, even airplane crashes. I saw an editorial blaming Reagan for airplane crashes. The notion is that life should be risk-free, and if it's not, then somebody is to blame. Last time we looked at this, sort of the genesis of this notion of the relation of the individual to history itself. The Times book review last week, and about a book about Disraeli, and it quoted Disraeli as saying, "Circumstances are the creatures of men, not the other way around." Now that, remember, I quoted Woodrow Wilson as saying, "History is but the lengthened shadow of great men." It's the same notion, that it's all there at the top. Good or bad, right or wrong, the guy in charge is the guy to blame. That is a perception. The other is, as we said, I think saw last week, that there are great impersonal forces that shape history. The most extreme of this, of course, is the Marxian determinant notion that modes of production, not people, are what shape history. Truth lies, obviously, somewhere in between. All right, magnitude of the war. One major perception of the struggle was the total dimension quality of warfare. It was a kind of mindless total war. Extraordinary physical effect on the country. It ruined Vietnam ecologically. It all but destroyed its economy. It inflicted enormous casualties, left terrible psychological scars on all of the participants. The statistics then are quoted, 1.2 million Vietnamese, 46,000 Americans killed, twice that number wounded. Some people use 56,000 Americans. Those are off the battlefield, non-combat casualties. 6 million tons of bombs dropped. There's another 6 million tons of ordnance expended from the ground or from the sea. 24,000 hectares of land defoliated. 11 million persons displaced at one time or another as refugees. All of this was heightened by the irony of the intentions of the participants, exemplified by the American Army Major, who told a reporter, "We had to destroy Mito Town in order to save it." Standing against this view is the view that in actuality, the Vietnam War was a war in microcosm. The lunar landscape syndrome, that the war was so devastated Vietnam that today it resembles a kind of later no man's land between the contending trenches of World War I, is simply an enduring fiction. The war was not a great titanic struggle. It was a war in which death and destruction was selective and far less extensive than other wars. There has recently been published a book called "The Tigers Are Burning" by one Martin Calden. And this is a history of the biggest battle ever fought. A single air-land combat engagement fought in World War II, the Battle of Kursk. I suppose very few of you have probably ever heard of it. I know a lot of Vietnam war historians who have never heard of it. It was a kind of showdown between the Germans and the Russians in World War II. 4 million men fought in this battle. 70,000 pieces of artillery, 13,000 tanks, 12,000 aircraft, a confrontation that lasted for 50 gruesome days. Now there was a real battle. Nothing in the Vietnam War that even remotely compares to this. A couple of other examples. The British, in one day or one weekend of fighting, early July 1916, along the river in Belgium, nobody's ever heard of since, lost 57,000 men killed. That's more than the United States lost in the entire Vietnam War. Now, according to this, again, this perception continues. Despite economic damage, there was during the war in South Vietnam considerable economic progress. A $12 billion plant investment, land to the tiller program, land reform program, various educational, medical, social welfare programs inaugurated. Far from ruining the South, what the war actually did was to bring it to the point of economic takeoff, which it would have done had the war turned out differently. By character of South Vietnam. One view was that South Vietnam was fragmented, anarchical, totally disorganized society. Its government was corrupt, repressive, and unrepresentative. It did not deserve to succeed, and in the end it failed because of its own internal weakness and shortcomings. The society itself was never viable. Most of the South Vietnamese hated the Saigon regime, were indifferent to communism, and cared little about who won the war. Most of the best people in the South were on the other side. The South Vietnamese army was incompetent and unmotivated, which is why it was outfought by barefooted guerrillas with homemade shotguns. That's one perception. Standing opposite this, the contending perception said that the South Vietnamese society was no more divisive in nature than comparable Asian societies such as Malaysia. It was simply subjected to greater strain. As governments go in Asia, the South Vietnamese government was more or less middling, that it was in representativeness or repressiveness, that it was better than some and worse than others. Under the circumstances of an armed enemy everywhere, it could hardly avoid a certain amount of authoritarianism. And in fact, it was much less totalitarian than most outsiders believe. Most South Vietnamese were militant anti-communists, particularly the 15% or so who were Catholic. Very few South Vietnamese wanted outright communist victory, which is why the South today is marked by re-education camps, trial of dissidents, why there's a resistance movement, a great exodus of people as boat people, why they hang themselves in camps in Hong Kong rather than to go back to forcibly be repatriated to Vietnam. The notion that people didn't care who won isn't even common sense. Massive evidence collected from studies during the war clearly indicated that what the South Vietnamese people wanted was a good, non-communist government. All right, the nature of the enemy. One perception is that the communists were superior. That is, they were uncorrupted, they were idealistic people fighting a just cause. They were also nationalists. They were dedicated, implacable in their devotion, certain of victory. In dealing with outsiders, as in negotiations with the U.S., they scrupulously adhered to agreements reached. They were perhaps authoritarian, but were enlightened, and were seldom bloody-handed. Further, they were independent people, fighting their own battles, self-contained, dependent on no outsiders. The other major perception of this is the number of competing perceptions. I'd say the major one is that the Vietnamese were actually two sides of the same coin. The North Vietnamese in personality and behavior were not much different from the South Vietnamese. If they appeared more attractive, this was simply ignorance on the part of the viewers. If their actions seemed more determined, it was because they were better organized. Corruption in the North was of a different kind, but it was just as common. In dealing with the U.S., they lied and they dissembled all throughout the war. In fact, the history of the war from the communist side is an unrelieved record of duplicity and deceit. Vietnamese communists used official terror, judicious and selective, but such rational treatment makes it more rather than less of an atrocity. Hanoi has proclaimed its self-independence, but the fact is this was a myth. There were no arms factories in North Vietnam, and it was in fact totally dependent on all on its allies for all of its military hardware. There was a third perception of the enemy held by many South Vietnamese and by some American military who fought the war, namely that the enemy was particularly brutal and ruthless, that they were fanatical, and Westmoreland was a favorite thesis of him, they were fanatical, they cared little about death. I've used that term a number of times. Their bloody-handedness was increasingly applied as a historical perception in the post-Vietnam War with the advent of Pol Pot and his rather unique experiment in socio-political organization. He and his original Khmer Rouge were bloody-handed butchers. Now that is a fact. It's not a competing perception. Argument there has to do why this is true. I mean, the notion that anybody does not care about dying always struck me as being an idea held by somebody who's never been at the gates of death any time. I'm very strong in this believer in cultural differences, but I think there are certain overriding human differences, and one of them is that you want to live, and nobody is indifferent to dying, if you've got all of his marbles at least. Westmoreland really believed this, so it helped to explain a lot of things that could be explained otherwise, I think. Of course, a battle. One perception was rooted in the notion of man, the spiritual atom bomb, to which were indebted to Mao Zedong. Communist forces could not be defeated in Vietnam. With guerrilla tactics being everywhere and nowhere, the U.S. and the Allied wanted firepower found very few targets. And the communists chose to stand and fight, as in the Tet Offensive of 1968, they won decisively. Lyndon Johnson acknowledged this, in effect, by resigning. The war demonstrated the failure of mass weapons against the human spirit. U.S. high-technology war, in the end, proved ineffective. Having taught the South Vietnamese to fight a style of combat so technically advanced it was beyond their capability, the U.S. then walked out, unable even to guarantee adequate logistical support to the South Vietnamese Army. In any event, the course of battle turned on spirit. The other side had it, but we did not. The other view was that the war was dictated not by spirit, but by technology. And as far as spirit goes, it was pretty much the same on both sides. This perception holds the basic fact that what happened in the Vietnam War was a technological revolution in warfare. The American Army never lost a single important battle in the entire war. South Vietnamese Army, after being trained and equipped, suppressed the guerrilla forces. That's why the entire North Vietnamese Army eventually was sent to the South. In the balance of forces, the South Vietnam was superior to the North when the Americans left in 1973. The 1968 Tet Offensive, whatever it may have done to Lyndon Johnson's career, was a military victory for South Vietnam. Not even for the Americans, but for the South Vietnamese. It is inaccurate to portray use of mass weapons in terms of totality. Actually, firepower was highly restricted, especially in North Vietnam. Bombings and airstrikes were almost entirely confined to the transportation and the communication matrix. One test of full use of this was the so-called Christmas bombings of 1972. That was the first time that there was all-out unrestricted bombings of the North. First time they had ever witnessed this, the first time I think they even had an idea of what it was. And it turned around the North Vietnamese and the Paris talks almost overnight. That's a more complicated, this is a perception I've given you. There's a more complicated explanation of that, but essentially I would say this is a factual perception. Incremental buildup of the U.S. forces, the camel's back syndrome, probably was an error, according to this perception. It was a part of a broader mistake, which was to try to win a defensive war. Rather, the U.S. should have struck north, or should have prepared the South Vietnamese army to invade North Vietnam. All right, inhumanity of the war. One perception is that Vietnam was the most horrible, brutal, atrocity-ridden war in history. It was primitive savagery augmented by modern technology. The war criminality by the Americans and the South Vietnamese was commonplace. The My Lai was the rule, not the exception. And nor were the communists without blame. Witness the Way massacre, the systematic assassination of village leaders, which amounted to genocide. Suffering was universal and inflicted on far more innocents than in previous wars. The other perception is that war is war, and while a humane war is a contradiction of terms, the Vietnam War was more carefully conducted than any earlier war. Rules of engagement were attempted, other restrictions on military actions were enforced for the first time really in any war. Atrocities were in fact less common, they were only better known. The communists, for their part, were not particularly bloody-handed, much of the exception in Cambodia. Much of their brutality stemmed from the kind of war that they conducted, a people's war, in which people are both the chief target and the primary weapon. The Americans would have preferred a war out and away from the population centers, in outer space even. But the communists forced a war over and around the people. And that was the war nightly viewed on American television, and thus left the impression that the war was more brutal than in other wars. I have a number of anecdotes and stories I can tell to illustrate this, but I think it's fairly clear. Negotiated settlement. One perception was that the peace betrayed perception. That is, the communists during all the war wanted and actively sought a negotiated settlement through peace talks or by some other means. The United States and the South Vietnamese were very intransigent about this, and it was that intransigence that kept the war going. The Paris Agreement reached in 1973 could have been reached 5 years earlier. When a settlement finally was achieved, it was at once sabotaged by the South Vietnamese, aided and abetted by the United States. Such is the long history of negotiations in Indochina. In a like manner, the 1954 Geneva Conference worked out a peaceful settlement only to see it destroyed by the South Vietnamese and the Americans. Another perception is that the war could not have been settled through bargaining because of the non-negotiable objectives involved. The Hanoi objective from the start was unification under its banner. Hanoi looked at any negotiation by asking the question, will this proposal or this idea, whatever it is, move us closer to unification? A South Vietnamese Vietnam which remained independent, even when run by the Viet Cong, obviously was not unification. Hence what Hanoi wanted, the other side regarded as capitulation. So what is there to negotiate? The 1973 Paris Agreement was not a peace treaty, and it was not a negotiated settlement. It was only a ceasefire agreement, and a poor one at that. It left the North Vietnamese Army in the South and called for an unworkable power-sharing arrangement among the contending forces. As for the 1954 Geneva Conference, it did not produce a master plan for Indochina. It merely extricated the French and swept the whole political future of Indochina under the rug. In fact, what it did, it made the subsequent Vietnam War inevitable. Ultimate outcome. Perception of the future as wave of the future or as an indeterminate outcome. One view was that the outcome was foreordained and inevitable, that the communists would win eventually. This is either because of the inexorable march of history, if you are a Marxist, or because the South Vietnamese society simply was not viable, or because the forces ranged against the South Vietnamese were simply too powerful and too well organized. The other major view takes a more indeterminate perspective. This is that the one immutable law of history is the law of change, that only simple-minded determinists believe that there is ever an inevitable outcome to anything in history. South Vietnam in this last decade had developed governmental cohesion and internal social strength. It was become